You can listen to The Professional Left on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or at our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, where you can also contribute to this podcast. There is a PayPal button at our website, or you can mail us a letter and or contribution at P.O. Box 9133, Springfield, Illinois, 62791.
This is the podcast for February 12th, 2016. It's not safe for work.
Recorded live from just behind the Republican candidate death march, it's The Professional Left with Driftglass and Blue Gal. Just keep walking. You're heading the right way. You're doing great. Everyone loves you. The band is playing. Rand Paul.
Rand Paul's gone. Yeah. No more Chris Christie to kick around.
Nope. Bye, Chris.
He can finally go back and do his real job.
Yeah, whatever that is.
Whatever that is.
Avoiding prosecution in New Jersey.
Yeah, avoiding prosecution, exactly. And thank the Lord Jesus, Carly Fiorina has dropped out.
Yeah, I think it was Rick Overton on the Stephanie Miller show this morning who said she's quitting to spend more time to scowl at her family. You all disappoint me. Everyone disappoints me.
Now, Andy Borowitz had an article, Carly Fiorina cheering herself up by firing campaign staffers. Yeah. So
she's waiting around.
And, you know, the only question left is, will she pay her staff or will she buy herself another boat? You know, because that's how she treated her Senate campaign staffers. So
I think she's still she'll be waiting around for the for her golden parachute check. Because that's what happens, right? You sign on, you drive it into the ground, you wreck everything you touch, and then you get a big payday.
A big severance,
and then you quit. So, waiting for
Where's
that big
my
check.
Severance? Yeah.
I get her
a bonus, right?
I just see her on a lawn chair out in front of her house smoking with her arms crossed waiting for the check to show up.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
In curlers, looking real mad. So, nope, Carly, check's not coming. We'll have to go on and do something else.
But and, Jim, you know, I hate to... Jim Gilmore.
Jim Gilmore's still in there.
He's hanging tough.
Carly Fiorina quit ahead of Jim Gilmore, so...
Think about that.
Live with that.
Yeah, okay.
Sit with that thought for a while.
Well, I think she is more involved in stemming the financial losses to herself and her estate, so...
Yeah.
That's what that's about. And now she can't not coordinate with her Facebook friends anymore. You know, that was the most blatant thing of the C.A.R.L.Y. for America. And, you know, that super PAC that just looked at her schedule on Facebook and then showed up with buttons and banners and signs and stage set up and microphone and what. Greeting committee and voter registration and everything else. But no, they weren't coordinating with the candidate.
No.
Yeah.
I think she'd go back to her original job at SPECTER.
Yeah. She's Spectre.
Yeah. She's a recording secretary, you know. After a year, she gets to be vice president or treasurer. And then eventually she'll work her way up through the organization and destroy them, too. So way to go,
yeah,
Carly.
Yeah, there you go. No, she'll be on Fox News on panels, you know, for the rest of her life. She'll be on ABC this week. She always has been.
That's the big question. Did any of these people do anything to cut into their future revenue from being a Fox News paid consultant?
No.
They're all going to do fine. They're all going to be able to appear on camera during the, you know, during the first terrible year of the Clinton or Sanders presidency to talk about how dire it all has been and how awful it was and how I warned you that they would destroy America and no one listened to me. No one listened. So she got her.
And I, you know, this is what I think the whole where are the transcripts of Hillary's speeches thing is about, is they want to know how they can get in on that payday. But, you know, I don't want to have to sit on Sunday morning and talk to George Stephanopoulos. I want to just go to Wall Street and make him $600,000 a pop. So, and we'll see what happens with that. We'll get into all of the Hillary stuff in a little bit.
Yeah. We had a visitor.
We did.
Out of town. We had
an out of town friend of the family. Ha.
Crashed. Just, you know, he didn't stay overnight.
He didn't come. He didn't come to see us either. No. The president of the United States was in Springfield, Illinois. He was, by MapQuest measurements, 1.8 miles from our house. It was much better to sit in our living room and watch it on TV than to try to stand outside the state house and say, can we get in? Hello.
Hello. Well, apparently there
professional
was,
left. Hello. Can we get in?
There was a ticketed group that got in at the Hoagland. Hoagland. And
to watch it. That's a theater.
Yeah.
The Hoagland Theater is like a block away.
Yeah.
Was that they were going to watch it on?
No, I think he dropped in over there and shook hands. And this was
personal
venue. There was a long line. When I was driving past there the other during the run up. I have pictures. I have pictures of police cars blocking streets off. So it's any town USA, any bad thing in any bad town in any town USA.
Thanks, Obama.
And so I must say I am a little jaded, having lived in Chicago and having met candidate Obama when he was running for state senate and stuff like that.
Yeah,
but. I worked in the South Loop during the Clinton administration, and every freaking weekend Bill Clinton was in town for some VVs or some barbecue or just to hang out or whatever. And you see the police dogs and the snipers and the traffic stops. And it was like, holy shit, you know, Clinton, go pick another town to pick on. And you'd always stay at the hotel that was near the college where I was working. So it was
a big pain in the ass every single time. Right.
It was kind of cool that it was happening. And it was also kind of cool to be nonplussed by it. Yeah, well, you know, Clinton's in town again. What are you going to do? So it's not that I've met like four presidents in my life.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of weird. Mm-hmm. Before, or after, or during their service. But it was really cool. I mean, he was here, and when I drove a middle child to school or home from school, rather, you know, it was like, he's like right here. He's in town. He's like a mile mm-hmm. from where we're at right now. I said, yeah, you can hear right there. I pointed to the skyline. He's right there right now talking. And that was a big deal. And it should have been a big deal. And this was the 9th anniversary of his announcing that he was going to run for president. That was the
on another very cold day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this is not the beginning, but this is the beginning of his victory lap.
Yeah.
Of his final, you know, tour around.
Because it was really a both-siderist come together, let's quote Lincoln, let's find ways. And he had some very specific, a laundry list of very specific reforms he wants to make to the election system.
Yeah.
Which is awesome, including ending gerrymandering and campaign finance. And, you know, he really did. Say,
voter
look,
registration,
same voter day. Registration, yeah. Same day voter registration, which Illinois is now about to embrace.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, he had some very specific things to expand democracy, to expand the electorate. But the rest of it was really, you know, he didn't say the extremes on both sides. I was waiting for him to say that, but he came very close.
And repeatedly. This was not a one-note rhetorical device.
Polarizing. He didn't like polarization.
Yeah. Civility.
And, let's have civility, and let's recognize that the way democracy works is when everyone is willing to compromise.
Yeah.
And both of us kind of looked at one another and went, so when are you going to compromise on that being a Muslim thing?
Yeah.
You know?
Well, and that's the thing. This was a great speech. This was an Obama 2009 speech.
Yeah.
And between 2009 and today, he has evolved or noticed or has gotten less, you know, less fucks to give, as we say, that he has said, he has given speeches where he said the Republican Party is basically out of their fucking tree.
Yeah.
If this is a problem with one of our two political parties, they are intransigent. They don't give an inch. He has been really clear in the second half of his second term that he knows goddamn good and well who is to blame for this. So I'm sitting there thinking, okay, why are we going back to the Ron Fournier speech? Why are we going back to this? You know, both.
Well, it's legacy. This is his 9th anniversary. This is legacy. He wants his legacy to be, I tried.
Yeah.
He wants to be quoted in the history books because he knows the history books are going to talk about the opposition was Kenyan Muslim usurper, birther,
and from the
block everything, do nothing Congress. I mean, he knows that.
From the day he gave his keynote address to his inauguration to the last day in office, he was trying his hardest to get mm-hmm. people to behave in a civilized, cooperative way. That's what he wants his legacy to be. I can't mm-hmm. say I blame him. I think he was also, you know, tossing the ball to Hillary.
Yeah, it was a very pro-Hillary speech.
It was very
I thought
much,
so, too.
You know,
yeah.
Those of us who can work across the aisle, working across the aisle is really important. If we can all learn to give a little bit, to get a little bit. This is how democracy works, people. This is how constitutional democracy works.
Yeah.
And again,
if
this were 2009 and he were just waking up to the fact that the Republican Party are seditious, intransigent, monsters.
Racists,
who
yes.
would rather burn the fucking country to the ground than let mm-hmm. any Democrat, but especially a black Democrat, govern at all. The only exception.
Well, and Driftglass, I was thinking about that. I was huh? thinking about, you know, what are the things that Barack Obama has been asked to compromise on? And when have Democrats been asked to compromise? Yeah. And when have they asked for compromise?
That was a line from the speech.
And it's like, yeah. And it's extend the Bush tax cuts or we'll shut the government down.
Yeah.
Or we'll hold the debt ceiling hostage.
It's always, or we'll nuke the economy. We'll
yeah.
destroy the country.
Yeah.
Destroy our credit.
Exactly.
Or else.
Yep. Defund Planned Parenthood or we'll shut the government down.
Yeah.
Everything is, you know, we're going to hold up all of your judicial appointments just because we can.
Yeah. The nuclear option is always the first option.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
This is sort of the equivalent of stand your ground. They just shoot at anything that moves. And
can I interject? I want
sure,
you to talk
sure, sure.
some more about Obama, but I want to interject some really low hanging fruit here.
Okay.
Louie Gohmert.
Oh Lord.
Today, this morning, had an explanation for Bernie Sanders.
Yeah.
Actually, it was yesterday, but they published it today. He said he knows why Sanders is doing so well in the primaries. It's because we let some of the hippies from the 60s influence the education system.
That's right. That's right. Goddamn hippies.
No, hippie teachers. No, it's hip, you know, and because, you know, then you can read the Communist Manifesto in class and nobody says nothing. So, you know, when that gets, then you're never going to get anywhere.
Funny,
so.
I don't remember cracking the People's History of the United States. I remember Howard Zinn in any history class I ever
no.
took ever in any school ever.
I wish.
Yeah, no. Sorry, that didn't happen. The only thing that came close was a couple of my teachers, I should say, really wanted to analyze some Beatles lyrics, man.
Yeah, I had that too.
And
Hotel California.
Yeah.
We had to analyze Hotel California
in class. Eleanor Rigby, man. And there's nothing inherently wrong with that, but it was sort of lazy class.
That is hippie. It's
your favorite song, man. That's the only reason to do this. I love this song so much.
I want to talk about this song with every class for 7 periods. Yes,
That's fine, but that's as far to the left as I got pushed.
Seriously.
Alternate school that I fell into some bad habits because they let a bunch of 17-year-olds decide everything by consensus, and that was a really bad idea.
That sounds like the Malheur uprising.
Yeah, it did
out
it,
in Oregon.
It did not. It was not. It did not work.
But I want to get to that in a minute. But let's finish up Obama.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to pull us off the track.
No. But
this is what you're dealing with. Obama can say, you know, we shouldn't have extremism, we shouldn't have polarization. But then you have Louie Gohmert.
Yeah. Well,
and that's the polarization. That's where the polarization is coming from: is truth versus fiction, President.
And you begin with this is something that I heard Paul Ryan saying on the radio yesterday before the speech started, or this morning, or yesterday morning before it started. And I got 2 seconds of it. I wanted to keep my breakfast down, so I decided not to listen to the whole thing. But I also happened across Rush Limbaugh's brother, who was writing, you know, wrote yet another long David Limbaugh, or I think his name, another long Jeremiad about Barack Obama's the worst, most traitorous, awfulest president who ever. Also Marco Rubio. They all have in common the following. Barack Obama has spent his entire presidency deliberately pitting Americans against each other. Barack Obama pitted gays against straights, men against women, whites against blacks, old against. That's his whole thing. Barack Obama has done nothing but try to divide this country and in order to sort of enslave us. And I just I step back and go, there are 20, 30 million Americans, probably more, who actually believe that shit, who really, truly believe that Barack Obama should never have been president. Was never legitimately elected, isn't really an American in some sense of the word. They're not quite sure how to put it together. And who has tirelessly devoted the last 7 years of his life to trying to destroy America using every tool at his disposal. And that is all part of a grand liberal plot to screw them over and hand our country over to evil foreigners. They really believe it. And there's nothing you can do with these people. They are the dead loss of our culture. There's nothing sort of waiting for them to shuffle off to their graves. That's going to be done with them. So given that that's just a fact, that is an indisputable fact, The idea that the President of the United States comes to Springfield and gives a speech about, you know, both sides need to learn to compromise. Okay, you're smart enough to know that that's bullshit. So why are you doing it? That's the question I asked myself. The first one was legacy. I want the history books to show I was a reasonable man, the only reasonable man in politics practically for since I decided to run in 2004. And that I want to hand off to my successor, a notion,
my Democratic successor,
the notion that if only we could find someone who could work across the true Obama legacy, that I want whoever it is that wins the primary process, Hillary Clinton, to embrace is if only we could all work together. If only we were all joined together. If only we could unite. If only and so the Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders have been fighting in a sense to say who could best reach across the aisle, rather than to say reaching across the aisle is a fool's errand. As long as Republicans have any power anywhere, they will use it to bring the government to a halt and fuck your lives up, and then blame the government for fucking your lives up. Break the government and then
And when they have power, if by some terrible disaster they were to get the presidency and have the Senate and the House, they loot the place.
Yeah, they would. And this was
Are the two options.
This is Ron Fournier's tweet this morning. You know, Barack Obama promised hope. He just never worked at it.
God.
Again, I firmly believe Ron Fournier is simply a congenital liar and a really, really disgusting, but he has also become the worst knock-knock joke in the world. Because every single fucking issue is, oh, Barack Obama and somebody else sort of blame for whatever it is that's bothering me today. And it's always that. It's just an algorithm that spits out characters. But somebody's paying him to do that. Somebody wants that to be the message. And so you saw this week this sort of weird reaction to both the end of the Obama era, the ending, the sunset on the Obama era, and the rise of Donald Trump and the Marco Rubio phenomena. So we're going to get to this in a minute. You saw David Brooks's weird column, but his usual partner in crime was Ron Fournier, and they both are working really hard to lie about the past, but in different ways. And we'll talk about them a little bit. But I want you to talk about Marco Rubio.
Oh, I just want to point out that I was right.
Yep. All along.
You know who could have told you that Marco Rubio was the Dan Quayle of 2016? Mm-hmm. Blue Gal could have told you, and she did. She told you on Twitter. She told you on the Facebook. She told you on everywhere. And I've been telling you this for months, and people have been pushing back at me on Twitter and saying, you know, a lot of people think he's really a smart guy. I think you're being really unfair to him. And all I said in reply to that, when people said that to me, was, I'm going to stand by my statement. He is as dumb as toast. He is Dan Quayle 2016, and he is the best candidate for the Democrats to run against because he's not bright.
Yeah.
And I wasn't character assassinating him. I felt like he loves his kids,
sure,
you know, tries hard to be a good husband, whatever. You know, I'm not judging him on any moral grounds at all. I'm just saying, I've been watching this guy, and he does not think on his feet at all.
And you can put your dick in a white suit and call it Mark Twain, but it's not Mark Twain. And you can pretend all you want that it's Mark Twain, but the day will come when someone will ask your dick a question about Mark Twain, and it will sit there and go, I don't know. And then you realize, this is just someone's dick.
But I want to connect this to the Malhurst standoff in Oregon.
Oh, please do.
Because we just, as of, you know, an hour ago, the standoff is finally completely over. Everyone's out. David Frye, who's this young, you know, diehard holdout, held out to be the last person to leave the facility. And I listened to it for probably way too long and finally turned it off because I thought he was going to commit suicide, but he did surrender. Blabbering on and on about feeling suicidal, and all of these two people, Michelle Fiore, who is the blonde gunslinging legislator from Nevada who flew and drove up to be there to help these guys surrender, and this other person who was live streaming the whole thing, who it turns out is also a real Second Amendment gun nut, who has actually I found out from Dave Nywert, been at a rally where he burned his gun permit because there should be no laws pertaining to gun ownership in America. So, but he had a radio show and the technology to live stream on YouTube all of the conversations with these standoff participants. Uh-huh. And near the end with David Fry, this guy who's 30-ish, maybe, young 30-ish, uh-huh. But mentally he's younger than my son. Yeah. I mean, he's, you know, 13. He wants no consequences to his behavior, and he wants his pot. And
that's right.
Isn't... And he, at the very end, it was stuff like, you know, I don't want my taxes to pay for what the United States did to Syria, because Syria was a good democracy before the U.S. messed it up.
Yeah.
So he's nuts. He's just nuts. And but he wanted his pot. And this was the part. This is the part that I want to connect to Dave, to Marco Rubio,
sure.
Which is you have Michelle Fiore and this other gun nut guy quoting the Bible, and Franklin Graham and Michelle Fiore and this third guy are all quoting the Bible to this David Fry over and over again. And Jesus suffered on the cross so that you didn't have to. And Paul went to jail, and it turned out to be God's plan, and God has a plan for you. And on about, oh, that, you know, God doesn't, and he was really suicidal. He was threatening suicide on the phone.
And his plan for you was prison, but we won't mention that
right
now.
Right. No. Well, and David Fry was really scared about that. And one of the guys came on the phone with him and said, no, I went to jail. Nobody raped me. You'll be fine.
How reassuring.
So
we're taking calls on this, are we?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Who's on line three? Oh, it's...
No, but why wouldn't they let me have my marijuana? Marijuana... Voting doesn't matter because marijuana didn't pass in Ohio. Remember that. I was in Ohio. I know. Uh-huh. And at that point, when he starts talking about how he wants his marijuana, and then he says, I'm not a Christian. I'm a Messianic Jew.
Okay. That's great.
And you have that is at the point when there's just this complete meltdown, and you realize that Michelle Fiore and Second Amendment guy and Franklin Graham have all attached their cause to this kid who is in a position to bring them power, and it fails. And I thought, this is just like Marco Rubio.
Yes.
Which is Marco Rubio is the exact right package for us. He's good looking. He's young. He will repeat what we tell him to say.
He's the empty vessel.
He'll be fine. And he's exactly what we need to push out Donald Trump and bring the George W. Bush voters, the person that you can have a beer with voters, back into the fold. He's not Jeb Bush, but he's from Florida. He's going to do everything we want him to do about taxes and Medicare and small government and big defense spending. And we'll get all that we want just by backing this guy.
And he tells
and
the crazy
meltdown.
People, and tells the crazies what Glenn Beck told him to say.
Exactly.
Because Barack Obama conspires against you every day of your life to destroy your life and ruin your children.
And the meltdown that happened on Saturday night was just like the David Fry meltdown today, which is, oh my God.
Holy crap. Holy crap.
This is not what we planned on. No.
Who cast this guy?
Right, exactly. Who cast this guy? And so... do I feel vindicated? No, I knew this was going to happen.
No. Vindication is not the right word.
Not the right word at all.
And this is a poor metaphor, but when the Iraq war went south exactly as predicted, and when all the people who had been smirking and laughing and calling liberals stooges and idiots had to stand there and watch it happen.
Oh, wait, this war has gone on for 8 years, and we are occupying.
Yeah. I didn't feel vindicated. I felt incredibly sad.
Yeah.
That, you know, this is trying to warn someone not to drive your country off a cliff and then watching it crash and burn doesn't make me feel good. It makes me feel sad. It makes me wonder, how many different times do I need to hit you in the head? How many times do you need to fail in exactly the same way before you learn? And the answer is they never learn. They cannot learn. They are constitutionally incapable of taking in new knowledge, because if they were, they really would be suicidal, because they'd have to look back in the last 30 years and say, oh, holy shit, I'm the reason this country's fucked up. Maybe I should, you know, maybe I should take a long walk off a short pier. And all I can say about the standoff, which you listen to, is some wags have taken to call it Standoff at Mayonnaise Flats. Well, one wag.
That one wag that I know and sleep with every night. Yeah.
And the other is, I don't know that these were David Fry's last words before he gave up, but I hope it was, I'm here to smoke pot and surrender to the FBI, and I'm all out of pot.
He was really all out of pot. That was the problem.
I'm all out of pot. And really, it was, wow. So you're holding out for that. It wasn't Jesus, and it wasn't Armageddon, and it wasn't my Second Amendment rights, and it wasn't Clive and Bundy, and it wasn't any of the other sovereign citizen shit. No, of course not, because all of that is bullshit. It's
well, and the point at which I unplugged the headphones and stopped listening was when Michelle Fiore asked him, are you standing up? Because you can just take a step outside the shack right now and come and talk to me. I'll give you a hug. Why don't you, are you standing up? And he said, no, I'm lying down enjoying my blanket right now. And he said, well, why don't you sit up and stand up? I don't want to.
I don't want. Yeah. All of that.
Okay, I'm done.
All of that ideological shit that the right sells is just empty shelving units where crazy people can store their crazy. They can find a place to stash, you know, whatever their bent batshit belief is. They'll find a home on the right because they all agree the government's evil and there's a massive conspiracy in some which way to deny them their natural right to rule over all of creation as God intended. And they all believe some variation of that, and the rules don't fucking apply to them. And so any paranoid idiot with any slightly different view, slightly different conspiracy theory, slightly different nut, as long as you keep the conversation at this level, he said, holding his hands up high, they all sound the same. Yeah. And then he pushed down a couple of inches. He goes, oh, you just want some pot. You just have the mind of a four-year-old and you want pot. I just want my weed and you're useful. You're cannon fodder for them. They don't really care what you believe. You're a useful someone we can shove in front of the camera and make them. You're a martyr for our cause.
Well, and you made me realize something, too, Dirk Glass. Yesterday, I was so angry that the House Republicans have decided to not even consider Barack Obama's budget. And just they're not even going to hold any hearings on it or anything. And the Black Congressional Caucus is really upset about this, that this is unprecedented and clearly based on some sort of racial, you know, the first Black president gets a budget that is just not even considered. But I realized this changes the conversation for the House Republicans from that spending bill that was shoved down their throats in December. You know, that's like 9 weeks ago. But boy, nobody's talking about that now.
Nope.
You know, the only person that talked about that is Donald Trump. Which is why he's winning.
Bless his heart. Bless his little heart. Yeah, it's a bad day for crazies.
It is.
They're dropping like the major crazies. The what I'm starting to think of as the Dalek versus Cybermen fight on the right between pure evil Ted Cruz and robot evil Marco Rubio is enormously entertaining. And presiding over all of this, of course, is Donald Trump, who won very convincingly. He won every demographic that voted in the Republican primary, pretty much. He won all the people who said they were crazy ass, you know, ultraviolet conservatives, were moderate conservatives, were young, old, et cetera. I believe he won pretty much every demographic in New Hampshire, which means nothing. I mean, you know, that's one state.
That's one guy, three Black state. Republicans voted for
all
him.
All three of them. They lined up behind him. But he won very convincingly.
Yeah.
And it has been a marvel to watch the tattered remnants of the Republican establishment who built this beast coming to terms with the thing that they made turning on them. And one of the most hilarious things I have read in a long time was David Brooks's long, wistful love letter to Barack Obama.
To Barack Obama. Yes. Why don't you talk about this
it's entitled something
like, a couple
minutes. I miss Barack Obama. I miss it. And to those of us out there who are students of the David Brooks form of fiction, because that's what David Brooks writes, he writes twig fan fiction, you recognize that this is not simply a letter of remorse and awesome farewell and golly, what a good guy Barack Obama was. I think Wonkette had the best headline, which was something like David Brooks Mrs. Barack Obama wishes he were still president.
Yeah.
But it was also a fragmentation grenade. It was a both-siderist attack on everybody except Marco Rubio.
Yeah.
You know, compared to Barack Obama, Hillary's a smelly pirate whore. Compared to Barack Obama, Bernie Sanders is insane. Compared to Barack Obama, Trump is a racist troll, and he goes down the whole list. And, well, Marco Rubio had that moment in the debate, but I found it to be charming. It showed his Wow. Just suck harder, David. Just try to
Hugh Hewitt, who is my alt-right boyfriend, by the way. I'm going to go on a cruise with Hugh Hewitt. Hugh Hewitt said, you know, Rubio won the debate except for those 3 minutes.
Except for those 3 minutes at Ford Theater. It was an awesome performance of our American cousin.
There was a commenter at Crooks and Liars that said, yeah, I won Powerball except for those 6 numbers.
Well, and I took it upon myself. My wife coined the Beltway Iron Rule of David Brooks.
The Beltway Iron Rule of David Brooks. Yes. May I?
Please.
It is, you are required to talk about what David Brooks said this week. Uh-huh. You are also required to never discuss what David Brooks said last week,
right,
or any time before that.
Absolutely. You're forbidden to discuss anything David Brooks wrote last week or before. It's because if you ever hold up a David Brooks column from any period of time other than this moment right now and the one he wrote today, oh my God, what a lying sack of shit. What a greasy, insincere douchebag this guy is. He wants to climb back on the bandwagon so that as Barack Obama sails off into history, he can say, golly, I miss that guy. You know, I was his favorite pundit. You know, he invited me. He loved me more than all the others. All the other kids, they said mean things about him. But I loved him. Even though I'm a Republican, I was a conservative, but I thought he was a great guy. Because that's how history is going to record Barack Obama. The problem is, if you go back and just read what David Brooks wrote in 2011, when he wrote this I'm a sap column, I believed he was going to be different, but he isn't. He snatched all hope out of our mouths and pissed all over us. He's a lying bastard. Because Barack Obama apparently discovered sometime around 2011 that the Republican Party was out to destroy him and started saying so out loud. And so just comparing line for line what David Brooks wrote when Barack Obama finally started talking about the Republican Party, even in the most gentle terms, as who they really are, as opposed to just willing to lose limbs in completely futile attempts to compromise with them. David Brooks loved Barack Obama as long as he was willing to bend over backwards and humiliate himself to find some Republican out there to compromise with and then fail over and over and over again and with a smile. Mm-hmm. As long as he was willing to be cheerful and nice, and David Brooks's idea of a compromising president, then Brooks has loved the guy. And the minute he said, you know, the Republican Party is something wrong with them. They won't compromise. They'll filibuster their own goddamn bills. Suddenly David Brooks tore up his trapper keeper, went into a weeping fit, and wrote this hysterical column that everyone commented all the time, of course. But the sub to Brooks column was, this election cycle is so bad. It's so mean-spirited and so uncivil and so awful and so off the charts, vicious and cruel. And I can't stand it. Why can't we have Barack Obama back, who's a model of rectitude and civility and an awesome guy? And isn't he sweet? Until you go back and read the David Brooks column from 2012, where he just trashed both Mitt Romney and Barack Obama as short-sighted, vicious, mean-spirited, partisan, backstabbing gangsters who are ruining the democratic process.
Mm-hmm.
And once again, this is literally 3 mouse clicks away from anyone who wants it. His good friend Mark Shields could look this up today. His good friend E.J. Dionne could look it up today. His good friend Chuck Todd could look this shit up today and say, hey, David, here's this weird thing. You said this thing about Barack Obama today, but see, 4 short years ago, you said the exact fucking opposite. What's the deal there, David? And again, as I've asked our listeners to do before, imagine the scope of the conspiracy required to make sure that no one ever asks David Brooks about the shit he wrote yesterday.
Right. It's a national Beltway conspiracy to not do that.
And the reason I focus on him is he is the perfect distilled example of that kind of person. You can be talking about David Frum, who's always on MSNBC. You could be talking about Ron Fournier. You could be talking about any number of pundits who are paid professionals who sit behind microphones and write columns, which are atrocious, which are awful, hypocritical, fraudulent, and fail on their own terms by simply comparing what they said today. I mean, Peggy Noonan, for God's sake.
Well, and I did a post at Crooks and Liars this week about Ash Wednesday and atonement, and I just had five tweets up from Bill Kristol and Peggy Noonan and on about, you know, Marco Rubio is going to be on the ballot. That's for sure.
For sure.
And Tucker Carlson cuts through the class warfare.
Yeah, Tucker Carlson. The working man's
friend. Thank God Tucker Carlson is there to cut through the class warfare, says Peggy Noonan.
Well, and here's a subject I've been kicking around in my head. It's not in our notes. I'd like to talk about it at some future date, but let me drop it out here as a reminder.
Okay.
Donald Trump might be changing the nature of how we talk about Twitter.
Yeah.
And here's what I mean by that. He tweets. I mean, that's how he communicates with the world from his weird, you know, aircraft.
And phoning in the Morning Joe. Yes.
But he tweets shit out and people take it and use that as the story.
Yep.
Donald Trump tweeted today. Donald Trump did. So Donald Trump is using Twitter as his primary, as his house organ, his primary.
And his stump speech. Yeah. Yeah.
So for Donald Trump, what he says on Twitter counts.
Yeah.
For everyone else, it doesn't count. Ron Fournier can lie his drooling ass off on Twitter. And no one at the Atlantic is going to look at him askance when he comes in the front door. Glenn Greenwald can comport himself in a manner that is most uncivil on Twitter. And no one on MSNBC is going to throw it in his face when he comes on the air.
Okay, but I want to talk about that from the standpoint of someone who now edits a big blog.
Right.
Because what Twitter has done, and this is, I realize this is a little bit of technobabble, but bear with me. Huh? Twitter makes all is working really hard to become Facebook, and I know a lot of people are really angry and disappointed about that. Twitter won't become Facebook because the users use it differently, and I really do have confidence in the users of Twitter to keep Twitter what it is, because they'll move to something else if this platform doesn't continue to work the way it is. But what Twitter has done in really the past, I think, 6 months, is make it possible to embed a tweet in a blog post.
Yep.
And this is as revolutionary as you and I both remember when we could use YouTube videos in our blog posts.
Yep.
It was a huge change in the way we blogged because all of a sudden we could show something that happened and talk about it. And as someone who is trying to get posts up on an hourly basis to a large audience, and all of us from Crooks and Liars to Talking Points Memo to, you know, Huffington Post, all these big blogs are trying to get what someone said when with evidence up quickly. This embedding a tweet is a phenomenal gift.
It is. Absolutely it is. Yep.
And so I think Twitter embedding tweets, you talk about Donald Trump doing it. I think the fact that I could go back and embed Bill Kristol's tweet from 6 months ago, and it was easy to find and easy to search and easy to embed, you know, that is going to hold more people accountable if we use it that way. So I encourage bloggers to do that. Oh, let me add something else to that, which is I went and looked. I don't think is David Brooks on Twitter?
Nope.
He's not at all.
Not
is
at
he?
All. Just an automatic.
It's a bot that puts up the titles of his
story,
his columns, and a link to them.
And then
right?
60 paid identical bots or people
who
rent their Twitter accounts to the New York Times all spit out retweets. In exactly the same term at exactly the same time every single time.
Okay. Well, I noticed that about Tom Friedman also yesterday when I was trying to put this together. I wonder what Tom Friedman said 6 months ago about X, Y, and Z. It is simply a bot that tweets out his columns and that's
it. Exactly.
So they are protecting themselves from exactly that thing of, you know, somebody going back and actually looking at what they tweeted 6 months ago. All you're going to get is a link to their column, which then you have to go have the firewall, have the paywall, whatever, find it, look at, you know, and I'm sure that that's policy at the New York Times.
Yep.
Except Paul Krugman tweets, doesn't he?
I think he does. And I don't know, but he has his own blog there, too. And David Brooks has his own blog that he never, ever uses. Paul Krugman blogs almost every day, like a real, you know, hard-ass blogger.
Right. And links to links to
Atrios.
So Atrios, and that's
doesn't
it.
Doesn't link to me. But he does link to Atrios. So they're both economists. They're both on the spectrum in the same place.
They're both on the spectrum, and they know each other face to face. So that's,
But here's the difference. Donald Trump will tweet something incredibly racist and false.
Mm-hmm.
And a reporter will say, here's something that Donald Trump said that it's incredibly racist and false. And it becomes a story. Bill Kristol will tweet something incredibly false and demeaning and awful. And George Stephanopoulos won't say, hey, on the air. Well, no, none of his colleagues, none of his peers will extend to him the same level of scrutiny.
But Blue Gal will.
Well, Blue Gal will. But none of the people inside the Beltway will pull a Bill Kristol tweet that is, you know, awful and lying sack of shit and just offensive as hell and designed.
Or more to the point, Hugh Hewitt. Yeah. Whatever Hugh Hewitt says on the radio
is complete. He's immune from.
Is off the TV. It's not on the TV. The streams do not cross at all.
And here's the thing: they cross for some people. For some people, mm-hmm. if you say one bad thing on Twitter, your career is over.
Yeah.
For other people, there is a blessed immunity. You're exactly right. Hugh Hewitt has it. Bill Kristol has it. Those sorts of people are allowed to get away with fucking murder on the air, on radio, in their own publications, on Twitter, on Facebook. And when they go on the camera, there is a conspiracy of silence among their peers to bring up the shit they said yesterday. And it is similar in a lot of ways to the David Brooks conspiracy of never mention what David Brooks wrote yesterday because it makes him look like a goddamn fool.
Right.
And that's that there is the fortress. That mm-hmm. whoever is immune from scrutiny is in the club, basically.
Yeah.
Whoever can say, Ron Fournier can shit all day long, can shit himself on Twitter all day long, can publish the most despicable shit on Twitter all day long, and no one at The Atlantic is going to say a word about it. No one's going to mention it when he goes on television. And there's something weird going on here because that wall is starting to become permeable. I'm going to be very interested to see what happens the first time someone holds up a Hugh Hewitt or Bill Kristol tweet to their face and says, explain this.
Yeah. We do have to get into the New Hampshire primary.
Yes, we do.
On the Democratic side, there is a debate tonight. We are recording on Thursday, and I'm getting to the point now with my life where we have to just record on Thursday and whatever happened Thursday night, we just have, you're going to have to hear about it next week.
So there's a debate every fucking night. Pardon my life.
Well, and youngest child has the day off of school tomorrow for parent-teacher conferences.
Okay.
So, things are going to be, I mean, this is what we do. And this melds with our life. And this is our gift to you, the listening audience. We are so grateful for you. And we know you are grateful for us. And we're doing it in a way that we can do the show. So thank you for tolerating that and do read Driftglass's blog and read, follow both of us on Twitter, and we'll try to stay in contact with you in those ways.
I write pretty much every day.
And read Crooks and Liars, which I write at Crooks and Liars every day now. So we're both writers and we're both on there, and go ahead and enjoy that. But I did want to say one thing about the New Hampshire results that I found a little disturbing. I'm glad Bernie won. I think he's running a much better campaign than Hillary Clinton is in terms. Apparently, he's using a lot of A/B testing on fundraising. He's doing a lot of his ads are fantastic. The one that you put up at your blog today. Oh, my God.
It's just
smart. It's exactly what I told you.
Again,
not feeling vindicated. But I said 2 months ago, look, the Democrats have to go full morning in America.
Right.
These have to be really positive ads and talk about how great it is, what a wonderful country we have. If we all give each other the rights that we deserve and respect each other's differences. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly the kind of advertising campaign that Bernie Sanders is doing. And it's brilliant.
And we are.
It's cheap. I mean, the ad that he put together is cheap.
Yep.
Not an expensive thing to produce,
It's inexpensive. It's a very well produced ad. We are not in the tank.
Well done on a low budget. Yeah,
we are not in the tank for Bernie Sanders. We are not in the tank for anybody. But it
Exactly. And I will be happy to vote for Hillary Clinton for president if she's the nominee.
Yeah.
And I mean that sincerely.
Absolutely.
I will be happy to do it.
And,
but I was disturbed in the results by the. I mean, part of it is. I know that Bernie Sanders, let's face it, is a local candidate in New Hampshire. And I think people who have not driven around New England do not realize how small everything is up there and how
everything is to everything.
Easy it is to people drive into New Hampshire from Vermont and into Vermont from New Hampshire all the time. It's just an easy thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
You might go shopping and do your grocery shopping in Vermont, and it's only a 30-mile drive from wherever you are in New Hampshire. You might vice versa.
I remember hearing
Vermonters
about
go over to
the effing,
to.
Remember hearing about the Bennies when I was working in Boston.
Yeah. So, and my ex-husband, who wrote the book on the Mann Act, which is about crossing state lines for immoral purposes, you know, that really restricted women's travel.
Mm-hmm.
It was a mania and a concern about trafficking in young single women that led people to pass this Mann Act, which basically is still on the books in terms of child prostitution, but isn't on the books in terms of preventing single women from traveling.
Right.
But I remember we went up. He's a alumni of Dartmouth, so we went up to Dartmouth at one point. And then all of a sudden we're in Vermont, and all of a sudden we're in Massachusetts, and all of a sudden we're in Vermont again.
What?
And he turned over to me, and, you know, we're getting ready to get married at that point. He says, but you see how easy it is to break the Mann Act around here. Because it is. They're tiny little states, and the highways crisscross, and you can be in one state one moment and one state the next. And so Bernie Sanders is local.
Right.
You know, he's the hometown boy. And so, of course, he's going to do extraordinarily well. On the other hand, in 2008, Hillary Clinton won New Hampshire over Barack Obama.
I remember it well. Mm-hmm.
And this year, and he won, Hillary Clinton won among blue-collar white voters, mm-hmm. white Democrats in New Hampshire. Hillary Clinton won that segment. And Bernie Sanders won that segment this time around.
Mm-hmm.
And it really makes me cavuto this whole thing, just asking the question. Just asking the question, because you can't say, well, it's because New Hampshire is so progressive that they voted for Hillary Clinton in 2008. That just does not pass muster.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I want to give everyone a break. People like themselves. You hear that all the time in business and advertising seminars.
And they teach people.
You put somebody on an ad that looks like you, looks like a mom,
In sales, you teach people to echo.
Yeah,
you know, to
sound
the
like you.
Gestures and the voices.
This is why Ted Cruz all of a sudden has a Southern accent.
Yeah. Well, everybody has a Southern accent.
Everybody now has a Southern accent. John Kasich has a Southern accent.
Mm-hmm.
Because people like themselves, and you want a candidate who's going to reflect your values. That's understandable. But there is something a little suspect about always voting for your tribe.
Yep.
And I expect something better than that from Democrats, and maybe I shouldn't.
Yeah.
We
should hold ourselves to a higher standard, and it's getting really kind of the elbows are sharp now.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of comments that you couldn't possibly have made that decision unless you are, you know, whether it's Gloria Steinem or it's Susan Sarandon.
Yep. Or Madeleine Albright.
The title of this podcast episode is Be Excellent to Each Other.
Be excellent to each other. Well, and remember the history of this, too. The battle between African-American women and white women in the suffragette movement was ugly.
Mm-hmm.
and we should not be proud of that. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea that Southern white women who were fighting for suffrage mm-hmm. would not appear in a parade with black women, and the compromise was, we will put white people in the parade, then we will put a line of police officers and white men, and then we will put the black women at the end. Uh-huh. And that's how we'll have the parade, so that to prevent violence. I mean, that's what we're talking about. And so, you know, there is not a proud history in the battle between women's rights, white women's rights.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I mean, especially the Gloria Steinem thing just really got to me. I'm like, oh hell, you know?
Come on. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Come
on. This is boomer privilege on parade. Stop it.
Yeah.
But we need to remember our history. And someone did say something to the effect of, really, we are more ready for an African-American president than a woman president. And I thought, well, yeah. There's a history of that. There's a history of being ready for women's suffrage and not ready for African-American suffrage that you know, flipped that coin back in 1920. So we let black women be subject to Jim Crow for a hell of a lot longer than white women had to put up with not having the vote. So,
and
just saying that out loud.
Which is why it's really important, I think, on our side of the aisle, to give each other the benefit of the doubt.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I will not say this across the aisle. I think
no, because there's so much fucking racism, blatant racism over there.
I think that the benefit of the doubt argument, or the argument of, you're arguing in good faith argument, is valid when you haven't spent the last 30 years absolutely fucking up everything and lying and just following every racist conspiracy theory down the rat hole, blaming mm-hmm. welfare queens for your troubles, blaming mm-hmm. brown people for your troubles, hating women, calling women feminazis.
Well, and let's just bring in Carly Fiorina again, just to bookend this whole thing.
Yeah.
That Carly Fiorina's plaintive cry about being excluded from the debate when she was, the last debate the last debate before the New Hampshire primary, you know, she would have had a lot more sympathy to her cause had she not lied about Planned Parenthood.
Yeah, exactly.
And her ability to be used as a female token mm-hmm. and then to go off and lie about women's health care.
And when you get caught, double down on the lie.
Double
die
down
the
against
lie.
Hillary Clinton. Yeah. So no sympathy there. No. For her at all.
I wanted to mention briefly while we're on the subject, but not in the direction I was going to take it, because you've got me thinking. John Lewis kind of unfriended Bernie Sanders today.
Let's end with this today, because this was pretty remarkable.
John Lewis, I'm reminded of a scene from The Color of Money, where Fast Eddie takes his protege into a pool hall in Chicago, and Orvis, his old friend, the young man proves is trying to buddy up to Orvis, and Orvis just looks at him like, you got Fast Eddie Felsen here with you, son. Mm-hmm. Who mm-hmm. the hell are mm-hmm. you? And that was sort of the kind of shade that John Lewis was throwing Bernie Sanders away. It was like, I know Hillary. I know Bill Clinton. I don't know Bernie Sanders. I was mm-hmm. there at the beginning. I'm present at the creation, and I didn't see him. And here's the thing. That's tough, man, because I love John Lewis. But here's the way I look at it. We've got John Lewis and Bernie Sanders and mm-hmm. Hillary Clinton all in the mm-hmm. same camp.
Yeah.
They're all essentially at the end of the day, they're all on the same team. And that's a wonderful thing. So don't let the fact that primaries are full of hurt feelings and bruises and ancient grudges being worked out let you forget the fact that John Lewis ain't leaving the Democratic Party. Bernie Sanders it will go back to being an independent if he loses, but he'll be caucusing with the Democrats. And Hillary Clinton is not going to turn around and tell her followers, march off the cliff and oppose Bernie Sanders and fight him at every... No, if Bernie Sanders is the nominee, she'll throw her support to him the way she threw her support to Barack Obama.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what you do after the primaries are over.
And we've got Al Franken and Elizabeth Warren as well. We've got great, great people on our side.
These are all professional.
And we've got Blue Dogs also. Yeah, okay, we do.
These are all professional politicians who know how this shit goes, who've been doing this their entire life and are pros at this. And we also have the Professional Love Podcast to bring it to you once a week. So we got that going.
God is love.
There's our Bible bitch segment for the
day. There's your Bible bitch verse for the day. Thank you, Driftglass. You know how much I love you. Happy Valentine's Day,
darling. Happy Valentine's Day. Happy Lent, too.
Oh, yeah. I'm giving up comment threads for Lent.
Yeah, that's smart. I can totally get behind that.
Each week, we post to our Facebook page and website an internet kitty sent in by you, the listeners. This week's internet kitty is Emily. Emily lives in Ohio, and she knows the difference between an internet kitty and a Republican is. With internet kitties, it really is all about her. You can send your internet kitty to us at our email address, proleftpodcast@gmail.com, where you can also write to both of us. Please send in your internet kitties. We could use a few more. Feel free to write us. We love hearing from you. Be aware that if you write us at any of our addresses, we reserve the right to read your email or U.S. Postal Service. Go Postal Unions! Letter on the air unless you say otherwise. Don't forget our gourmet coffee guideline. If you can afford to buy an espresso-based beverage for yourself, buy one for us. If you're going to take your Valentine out for an espresso-based beverage, send us a Valentine with a $5 contribution. Don't forget, if you're shopping for your loved one for Valentine's Day on Amazon, to use our link at our website. Yes, if you're not buying flowers or candy or teddy bears or diamonds or whatever it is locally, go to Amazon and use the link at our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com. We believe in buying local, but we also believe in shopping Amazon with our link if your alternative is a big box store. Approximately 1% of our listeners support this podcast with a contribution, and you can too. Again, see our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, for details, or you can just Google Professional Left. It comes right up at the top. Both our PayPal and postal address information is there at professionalleft.blogspot.com. Please rate our show on iTunes or Stitcher Radio, and thank you for doing that. That does help us. A thumbs up at Stitcher, 5 stars or 4 stars or whatever you want to give us on iTunes, puts us, especially as we are in an election year, puts us at the top of news and politics websites, and that helps us a lot. So thank you for doing that. Hey, Driftglass. How are the internet kitties doing this week?
You know, Blue Gal, the internet kitties think the FBI should have given those Oregon standoff guys some weed about 41 days ago.
Let's think about living.
Think about living.
Just think about loving.
Think about loving.
Just think about the hooping and the hopping and the popping and the loving, loving, dubbing. Let's forget about the whining and the crying, the shooting and the dying, and the fellow with the switchblade knife. Let's think about living. Let's think about life.
Left Podcast is recorded under a Creative Commons license, copyright 2016, Driftglass Blue Gal Podcast.
Minecraft is awesome! Now it's time for Science Fiction University with our science fiction expert, Driftglass.
Science Fiction University, Driftglass, this week we're going to stump you. I swear we're going to stump you.
Bullshit!
Bayen Publishing, B-A-E-N. They actually publish science fiction works, and they're still taking submission. Bane?
Yeah.
Am I saying it wrong?
Well, the only reason I know that is because Harlan Ellison made a point of pointing out that Bane is a homophone for two words, one with a meaning opposite of each other. Mm-hmm. One is bane of your existence. One is a wonderful place that Jim Bane does great things and publishes stuff. So I think it's Bane.
Okay, great, great. Well, it's Bane, and they have online, you won't believe this, a Heinlein quiz.
I was going to say an open submission thing. No,
well, they also have an open submission thing. They will take, they don't take them by email because they got too much spam, but they have a submission form where you can submit your stuff. So that's cool.
Maybe I'll do that.
But they only publish science fiction, so just be aware of that. Here's what they say at their website. Hail Robert A. Heinlein and long live the Dean of Science Fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Think you know your stuff when it comes to Robert A. Heinlein? Well, prove it, Space Cadet.
Okay. Well, I will do my damnedest.
All right. So here we go. To celebrate the release of a new paperback edition of Farnham's Freehold, complete with an all-new celebrity foreword by Heinlein biographer Bill Patterson.
Ooh.
Here's a quiz to put you through the paces and test your Heinleinian mettle. Beware. No namby-pamby softballs here. This Heinlein quiz is a harsh mistress.
Bullshit.
Tan stuff, which means there is no such thing as a free lunch, right?
No. Absolutely. There ain't no such thing.
There ain't no such thing as a free lunch, right? No, we're pretty sure there are at least a couple of questions here that you cannot find answers for on the internet. If you survive this quiz, then facing down a bug invasion should be a piece of cake.
Sure.
All right. Let's see how this goes.
The bugs don't invade. Everyone knows that.
They attack.
They bomb from space.
Yeah. All right. Number one, Driftglass. And these are multiple choice, but screw that. Unless you ask me for multiple choice, you're not going to get it.
All right. Fine.
All right.
Go ahead.
Number one, why did Heinlein retire from the Navy?
You know, he just thought the life in the military was sucky and hated America. No, he had tuberculosis.
That's correct. He caught tuberculosis.
He was a lunger.
Yeah. He did not lose a portion of his left leg in a friendly fire accident. That is one of the options.
In fact, one of his stories is about his experience having to have his lungs treated.
Ah, okay.
There were two deaths that happened right in front of him.
Oh, wow.
And it was a fairly tricky procedure at the time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right, number two. Robert A. Heinlein considered this writer his overall favorite and actively collected this writer's works, including obscure tracts.
All right, give me my choices.
A, Herman Melville.
Nope.
B, Edgar Rice Burroughs. Man. C, Mark Twain.
Yep. Ding, 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 ding. Mark Twain. Go no
Mark
further.
Mark Twain, yes.
Oh, yeah.
It's not Emily Dickinson. No, it is Mark Twain. All right.
Nothing wrong with Emily Dickinson,
no.
But it was Mark Twain.
It was Mark Twain. Number three. What science fiction element plays a major role in Farnham's Freehold?
Racism. Actually, it does. If you read it, it actually does.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It's got a couple of racist references in it. But it's... the Northern Hemisphere is wiped out and the Southern Hemisphere survives. And
oh, wow.
Roles of people of color and people who are not of color are reversed.
Oh.
And the Northern Hemisphere is now basically kept as a vast estates for the lords and ladies of the future who are slaveholders.
I see.
But the two major elements are nuclear war and time travel.
Time travel is correct. Yes. All right. Number four, in Farmer in the Sky, it makes a big difference in the story, and I'm going to have to make this a multiple choice, I'm afraid.
Okay.
It makes a big difference in the story, Farmer in the Sky, that William Lerner is A, a girl disguised as a boy, B, a former member of the Astrogators Guild, C, an Eagle Scout.
Ding, 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 ding.
It is not D, illiterate, but possessed of a photographic memory. All right.
That would be Andrew Libby, I believe.
Okay. Well, this is William Lerner in Farmer in the Sky.
Heinlein wrote a lot of stuff for Boy's Life and for scouting stuff, and a lot of his juvenile heroes were able to get out of tough scrapes because they had their merit badges.
Yeah, yeah.
I think scouting is awesome. I think the skills they teach you in scouting are awesome. I think they have some really
it makes it a MacGyver kind of situation, too, where, he uses his pluck and cunning to get around. So for then he's been trained at, like you say, as Boy Scout. All right.
Well, his pluck and cunning and ability to splice wires and climb trees and build fire.
And start a fire. Yeah, sure. All right. You're going to get this one, Driftglass. Let me finish the quote before you answer it, because
sure.
I know you and I have talked about this one before.
Okay.
What science fiction writer said this about Robert A. Heinlein? Quote, several years ago when I was ill, Heinlein offered his help anything he could do, and we had never met. He would phone me to cheer me up and see how I was doing. He wanted to buy me an electric typewriter, God bless him. One of the few true gentlemen in this world, he knows I'm a flipped-out freak, and he still helped me and my wife when we were in trouble. That is the best in humanity there. That is who and what I love.
Oddly enough, that was Emily Dickinson.
No, it was not
Emily Dickinson. It was Philip K. Dick.
Philip K. Dick. You have mentioned that to me several times. So
I have been on the receiving end of largesse from authors whose work I admire, and it is quite... an amazing blessing out of nowhere.
It really makes your whole
year
when you hear from another writer that you respect. say, oh, I like your stuff. Yeah.
It means a lot.
All right. Number six. In Have Spacesuit Will Travel, A, young Thorby inherits a spacesuit from his beggar father, who is really a spy in deep cover. B, young John Lyle revolts against his job as a palace security guard for the sake of love, and then wanders the spaceways after being rejected. C, old Mary Sperling must decide between immortality and love. Or D, young Kip wins a decrepit spacesuit in a cheesy advertising contest.
Those are all Heinlein plots. I think they're all.
I think they are, yeah.
But it's D. It's number four. It is. Here's a crappy spacesuit, kid. Enjoy it. And he does.
And he does enjoy it. So there you go. Number seven. To whom is the science fiction writer and critic Damon Knight referring in this passage? Andrew of Glass, please let me finish the passage before you give me the answer.
I'll try. I'll really try.
We really are talking about a Heinlein expert with my husband. So I know he knows this one, but yeah. He has mentioned this to me before, too. Actually, you've mentioned this to me in light of myself. She is a chemist, biochemist, aviation test engineer, experimental horticulturist. She earned varsity letters at NYU in swimming, diving, basketball, and field hockey, and became a competitive figure skater after graduation. She speaks seven languages so far and is starting on an eighth. Damon Knight wrote that about whom?
That would be Robert Heinlein's much better half, Virginia Heinlein.
Yes, that's right.
His second wife, I believe. There was some getting rid of the first wife thing going on there. But most of Robert Heinlein's female heroines are Virginia Heinlein.
Yes.
Red hair, really smart, much
and sexy.
Smarter. And smart and sexy and interested in sex. They like sex. They like having sex. They are very comfortable with their bodies. And they are 9 times out of 10 way smarter than their husbands.
And you mentioned that in context with your wife, which I think is very sweet. That's very sweet of you.
Frequently. And Robert Heinlein, and as I recall, I mean, there's a million stories, but one of the ones that kind of cracks me up is he and she both, to make an important plot point in a story, they had to figure out the ballistic movements of a moon.
Mm-hmm.
And they both did the math on a long piece of butcher paper and then swapped it and checked each other's answers to make sure that they were right. And they were telling this to a young scientist at the, I think, Jet Propulsion Laboratory, because they were, you know, young scientists and astronauts loved Heinlein. They, you know, he's their sort of, you know, godfather. And they were sort of showing him around, showing their favorite uncle how things work. And they said, well, why don't you just run it through a computer? And Heinlein said, this is like in 1942. There were no computers. Everything was done by hand. Everything was done with a slide rule and by hand, son. Oh, okay. He's a very bright young man, but, you know, didn't ever grasp the idea of a world before computers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, Dirk Glass, this is our last show before Valentine's Day.
Yes, it is.
And I want to tell everybody, I want to brag to everybody that this morning I told Dirk Glass, thank you for falling in love with me. And he said, I couldn't help it.
That's right. I had no choice. Officer, I had no choice, officer.
All right. Number eight. What does to grok mean?
Oh, see, this is a trick question.
Okay.
This is definitely a trick question. Because grok has a really specific definition in the Martian vocabulary. And in fact, I believe there's a passage where someone asks the protagonist, Valentine Michael Smith, grok means to drink. He says, yeah, grok means to drink. And that's all it means. But it means everything else, too. It means to fully comprehend, fully understand, fully consume something else mentally and emotionally so you can actually identify with it perfectly.
It is to fully understand in a complete and total manner. That is correct. All right. Number nine. One of Robert A. Heinlein's most famous statements on democracy was actually spoken by one of his characters. And here is the quote. Democracy is a poor system of government at best. The only thing that can honestly be said in its favor is that it is about 8 times as good as any other method the human race has ever tried. Which Heinlein character said this? And I will give you multiple choice.
Okay.
A, Jubal Harshaw in Stranger in a Strange Land. B, Johnny Rico in Starship Troopers. C, Hugh Farnham in Farnham's Freehold. D, Lazarus Long in Time Enough for Love. Or E, no, it was Heinlein himself who said it in Take Back Your Government.
Well, this is kind of a trick question. It's not really. It was Jubal Harshaw in.
It was.
In Stranger in a Strange Land.
That's correct.
But really, I mean, people have written, you know, master's theses on the various Heinlein character stages. There's young man, middle-aged man, old man. And old Heinlein male protagonists all sound suspiciously alike. And they all sound like Robert Heinlein. They all sound a lot like Robert Heinlein. The young one is the cocky one who is basically good at heart and wants to save the world and has to learn some brutal lessons. The middle one is the sort of the middle-aged guy who sort of got the world figured out. He's at the top of his profession, or he's, you know, it's consulted by many. And the old one is the wise old man. Mm-hmm. And Lazarus Long is the ultimate wise old man. Mm-hmm. So it could have been him, but it was Jubal Harshaw.
It was Jubal Harshaw. That is correct. All right. Number 10. This is a true or false. Contrary to popular legend, Heinlein never made an acronym of the phrase "there ain't no such thing as a free lunch," transforming it to Tanstoffel in "The Moon is a Harsh Mistress." Is
bullshit.
True or false? Yeah, that's false. Bullshit. You're right.
That's the Martian flag. It's also the most common saying.
True. It is on the Martian flag.
Lunar flag.
The moon. It is on the flag in "The Moon is a Harsh Mistress." Correct.
And the reason it's on the flag and the reason that the moon's a harsh mistress is the moon is a penal colony.
Yep.
And once you're sentenced there, basically you and your family are there forever. Mm-mm. Because if you're born there, you can't leave. So it is a slave colony as well.
And there you go.
It's a brutal one. And eventually, sort of a brutal Darwinism takes over, sort of a rough and ready, politeness-driven Darwinism takes over. And everyone learns there ain't no such thing as a free lunch.
All right. Number 11. There were a dozen Heinlein juveniles published by Scribner's.
Uh-huh.
But Scribner's rejected one Heinlein juvenile.
Man.
Which one was it? And it was ultimately published by Putnam.
Yeah,
which book was it?
It was ultimately published by somebody.
yes. Clearly.
Heinlein stories. I think he had that deal with John Campbell, if I'm not mistaken. You will publish everything I write. I will fill out your magazine with stories. The minute you turn away one of my stories, I go someplace else.
Mm-hmm.
And then I become compete on the market. I think this Campbell turned away with Surf, but I'm not sure about that.
No,
Gulf. But
no, it's not Gulf. It's Starship Troopers, believe it or not.
Yeah.
All right.
Gulf was, I think, the short story that was turned away. But yeah, I think he did a juvenile every year for Christmas, around Christmas time. I'm not sure about that. But yeah, I didn't know that was The Moon is a Harsh Mistress was the one.
All right. Number 12.
Mm-hmm.
Where did Robert A. Heinlein grow up?
Oh, please. But this is where my ancestors are from, more or less. Yeah. Missouri.
Kansas City.
Missouri. Yeah.
Kansas City, Missouri. All right.
And that shows up in some of his stories, too.
Does it really?
Everything's up to date in Kansas City, honey.
All right. Number 13. By the way, there are 20 questions here. I just wanted you to pace yourselves, all right?
Exhausted.
Number 13, in the green hills of Earth, all of the following is true of space barred wristling, except which one?
Yeah.
Number one, A, he is the creator of a famous anthem of spaceways.
He is.
B, he is blind.
Yep.
C, his famous song also shows up in Farmer in the Sky.
Does.
D, he began his career as a jet man.
He did. He lost his eyesight.
E, he never actually lived on Earth.
Wrong. Nope.
Oh, you got it already. Okay. That's correct. He did live on Earth. All right. And F, his songs were usually ribald and scurrilous.
Yes, they were. They were dirty. They were dirty. They weren't like hardcore gangster raptor, but they were. And I think that's how he sort of got around.
The censors?
No, I mean, that's how the character managed to travel.
Oh, okay.
He would exchange entertainment for passage.
But and, they were kind of pirate.
Yeah, they were. Type. You know the kind of song that Quint would sing in Jaws. Here's to swimming with bow-legged women. That kind of song. Yeah, that's the sort of thing he would sing.
All right.
Yeah.
Number 14. What is the name of Rico's enlisted unit in Starship Troopers?
I don't know what his enlisted unit was, because he enlisted one, and then they got wiped out. He was transferred someplace else. They got tattoos or earrings or something. But he eventually ends up with the Roughnecks.
It is the Roughnecks. It starts out with the Roughnecks, Raz Snacks Roughnecks.
Yeah, and ends up as Rico's Roughnecks.
See, Rico's Roughnecks at the end.
He rises. And one little plot point for you Heinlein aficionados out there. His father enlists in the military and ends up as his second in command.
Okay. Number 15. On what planet or heavenly body is the Menace from Earth set? Is it A, Earth, of course, B, Pluto, when it was generally considered a planet?
No. Nope.
C, not on a planet, on Earth's moon.
Yes.
It is?
Yes.
It is. You're right. It is, yes. Earth's moon. It is not D, Mars, or E, Klendathu.
Klendathu is the bug planet.
In Starship Troopers.
Troopers. But yeah, because Earth is always screwing with people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you set up a decent Martian colony, a decent lunar colony, and Earth is always fucking with them, trying to get them to do stuff and interfering with them. So, yeah. Yeah.
All right. Number 16.
Okay.
Which novel is usually considered the final story in the internal story chronology of Heinlein's future history?
Fair. Not fair.
Is it A, To Sail Beyond the Sunset, B, Tramp Royale, C, Methuselah's Children, or D, Stranger in a Strange Land?
Well, Stranger in a Strange Land is in the 60s or 70s, so that's not it. The timeline runs out to like the year 4000 or something.
Mm-hmm.
And the long-lived character that extends most of that distance is Lazarus Long.
Mm-hmm.
So the story of Lazarus Long is Methuselah's Children. So I'm going to go with I want to say Time Enough for Love, but that's not an option.
Mm-mm.
So I don't know. I'm going to guess Methuselah's Children, but I'm probably wrong.
It's the To Sail Beyond the Sunset.
Oh, okay. All right.
Number 17.
I feel bad now. So bad.
You missed one.
Yeah.
You missed a couple. Number 17. In Starship Troopers, Rico's mother, A, disowns him for joining the military. B, is killed in the bug attack on Buenos Aires.
Beats.
Yes, you're right. I don't. Need to go any further. She does not join the army.
No, Dad.
And she does not become a human slave of the bugs. Okay.
Well, I didn't read that part. Maybe. No. Yeah. The Buenos Aires is wiped out. The whole city of Buenos Aires is wiped out.
Number 18. Mm-hmm. In The Moon Is a Harsh Mistress. Mm-hmm. The loonies finally secede from Earth using what?
Oh, this is awesome. Yeah. Their industry is producing wheat, I think, some grain, and shooting it at Earth in metal canisters. And they hit upon the plan of filling up the metal canisters with rocks,
mm-hmm.
and firing them at Earth down a magnetic sled, a magnetic sling that fires them down the gravity well at Earth. That hits with the impact of an atomic bomb. There's no radiation, but it certainly puts on a bright show. So they fire canisters, rocks, at Earth down a magnetic sled. Actually, two sleds, because the Earthers know where the first one is because it's part of their factory, part of their industry. So the loonies secretly build a second one.
Ooh.
And just when the Earth is going, we wiped out your weapons, sucka. In come four more. Like, holy crap, you've got a backup. We had no idea, which is kind of cute. And the way
that's essentially what happened with Truman and the Japanese, too, when you think about it, because Hiroshima happened and then Nagasaki happened. It was like, oh, no, they might have a third one.
We had a warehouse full of this shit.
Yeah.
It was very effective. And I believe they were very specific about not targeting population centers.
Oh, unlike Truman.
Yeah. The first pass was for demonstration purposes only and precision purposes only. Can you form a perfect square? Because the ballistics for that are tricky. But yeah, it was a very effective weapon because you're dropping rocks on them, and you know what the moon has a lot of.
Rocks.
A lot of rocks. So they can do this all day.
All right. Number 19. In which Robert E. Heinlein book is Mother Thing a main character? A, The Star Beast. B, Citizen of the Galaxy. C, Have Spacesuit Will Travel. Or D, The Number of the Beast.
It might have shown up as a minor character in The Number of the Beast. I'm not going to say it did because The Number of the Beast sucked. If you're going to skip a Heinlein novel, skip that one. Because that's the one where he tries to tie all of his novels together into some meta universe of all novels ever written by Robert Heinlein. And it doesn't work. He was paid a shit ton of money for it. I'll say The Star Beast.
I'm sorry, what?
In fact, I will say Star Beast.
Okay, no, you're wrong. It is Have Spacesuit, Will Travel.
Yeah, I hate this.
Last one.
Okay.
Number 20, quote, he is not only America's premier writer of speculative fiction, but the greatest writer of such fiction in the world. Who said this about Robert Heinlein? Was it A, Lurton Blasingame, B, Donald Rumsfeld, C, John W. Campbell, D, Stephen King, or E, Tom Clancy?
Probably not John Campbell, since speculative literature, or whatever they're calling it, they didn't gussy up the genre until the 60s. So probably not him. I'm going to guess Tom Clancy.
It's Stephen King.
Oh, well, hey.
Who took a break from typing his 45 books that he's writing this year to say something nice about Robert Heinlein. Okay.
Yeah. Well, that's pretty high praise coming from...
It really is. It really is. Yeah.
And you can disagree... you can disagree profoundly with Robert Heinlein's philosophy.
Yeah, or his politics, militarism. Yeah.
But it's impossible to ignore the fact that he really shaped the science fiction genre, set the parameters, and wrote some of the canonical works of it. And he was the first, one of the very first really good writers who understood how to write, build, engineer, create a damn story. And not just say, look, it's gadgets and bug-eyed monsters.
He wasn't exactly a feminist.
No.
Even though his women characters were sexy and smart and, they were sexy and smart because...
Yeah,
he liked sexy, smart women. So.
Yeah, well, his female characters had a lot of autonomy, especially for the genre they were in. And they got more autonomous right through Friday. Friday was probably his last novel where there was a strong female character who was the protagonist. I would not look to him for lessons on how to run... I would recommend sort of how to run your government. I remember giving that Take Back Your Government book.
Yeah.
Sort of because one of the things he did say was it's really important that you get deeply involved in politics, throw yourself into it, and have your heart broken by some stuffed shirt who is an asshole. It's sort of like it's really important to fail at business. It's really important to give your heart to a politician and have it broken. It's important to learn these things. And then sort of draw your own conclusions, read a lot, study a lot, never stop thinking about things, never stop taking in as much information as the world has to offer. Don't get absorbed in trivial minutiae. Don't get absorbed in the ephemeral stuff. And his politics were way to the right of mine. But he wrote a good story.
Mm-hmm.
No doubt about it, man. The guy could write. He knew how to write for juveniles. He knew how to write for kids. And he knew how to write really good adult science fiction and built a good foundation for the genre that is still going today. So,
all right. Drift Class, you did all right.
Yay.
You get the Water Brother rating.
And I know what that means.
What does that mean?
When you share water with someone Strange from a Strange Land, you become brothers. It's a blood brother. You are sworn to each other. And it's a ritual on Mars because water is very scarce on Mars.
If anyone else is scoring themselves, if you got 1 to 5 right, you're between planets. 5 to 10, you're space cadet. 10 to 15, you're a jet man. 15 to 19, you're a water brother. And if you got all 20 right, you make the dean's list.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Drift Class, and thank you for having this online. We appreciate that, and we'll be back next week with another episode of Science Fiction University.
Another exciting episode of Science Fiction University.